This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Americans chose Donald Trump to be the next president of the United States. We're dedicating our program today to what this means. Some people are calling it a miracle. Others are calling it a nightmare. We're going to evaluate this from a unique perspective, as the Trumpet always does, trying to look at it in terms of what it means for America based on the prophecies of the Bible. I'm here in the studio with a panel of our Trumpet writers. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
We have Philip Nice.
Good morning.
And Andrew Miller.
Good morning.
So in our discussion today, we're going to focus on a few key questions. First of all, what does this tell us about America that Mr. Trump won? Elections are always moments of truth, in a sense. The media analysts, the pollsters, the prognosticators, they all kind of have to sit back and listen to what the people say. And for America, this was a very unique campaign, a very unique election for a number of reasons, and there are really a lot of lessons that we can take from this. We're also going to talk about what might happen in the time ahead because Mr. Trump won. This was the most polarized election in a long time, maybe ever. So there were a lot of people now who are disappointed, they're angry, they're deeply emotional. What might the social climate be like? What sort of backlash will we see from his detractors? And on top of that, what might President Obama do in the final 2 months of his presidency, knowing that he'll be turning things over to a man who he calls temperamentally unfit to be president? We also want to talk about what a Trump presidency might look like, what the implications might be in domestic policy and foreign policy, how other nations will react, and what will happen to America's place in the world. And we'll maybe have time to take a brief look at a few of the other issues that were decided in this election. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. It was a highly polarized election. It seems like the general feeling leading up to it was summarized something like what Woody Allen once said. He said, "We stand today at a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness. The other leads to total extinction. Let's hope we have the wisdom to make the right choice." But looking at what happened, it seemed like maybe there was more enthusiasm for Donald Trump than people expected. What does this election result teach us about America? There were a lot of factors that came together to bring about this result. And it's interesting to hear people talking about this and trying to interpret the election results. I think, first of all, it's worth noting that a tremendous amount of the support for Donald Trump was about what Americans are angry about. There was definitely a lot of anti-Clinton sentiment. People who are upset over all of the reports of corruption that follow her around, the concern over her emails, the Clinton Foundation, the FBI investigations. There was also a lot of protest against current politics, a very strong anti-Obama sentiment, anti-Obamacare, anti-open borders, anti-government regulation, anti-establishment, a protest against the way the radical left has been usurping power, trashing the Constitution, and so on. So all of that negative sentiment certainly played a huge role. So there's a lot of this support for Donald Trump that was essentially a vote of discontent, a vote against what's happening to the country. And people just saying, we want anything different than what we're getting. And you can even look at his political success as a protest against the Republican establishment. A lot of his support came from people who were sick of that establishment. So what do you make of the anger message from American voters, the protest against the status quo?
Yeah, that's the thing that stood out the most to me, is just how much the mainstream media and most media outlets just underestimated that anger against the status quo. I mean, looking at in the weeks and months ahead of this, I mean, most media outlets were predicting a Clinton blowout of well over 300 votes in the Electoral College, and which obviously did not happen. And it looks like the two big upsets that tipped this in Trump's favor were that he managed to get a victory in Florida, which was a close race, and for the first time in almost 30 years broke what they called the big blue wall of the Midwest. It looks like he's won Wisconsin, he's won Pennsylvania, still looks like he'll get Michigan, which these have been Democratic strongholds since 1988. And it is just what you were saying, just this backlash is that from what most of the analysis I saw, the Florida vote, they said it looked like he was actually tipped over by Cuban Americans turning out for Donald Trump in higher than expected numbers. People who they lived in Cuba, they've fled to the United States, fleeing persecution from the communist Castro regime, watched President Obama open sanctions and make deals with that communist Castro regime without asking for anything in return. And that was really seen as a huge betrayal by a lot of Cuban Americans. They were hoping that these sanctions would eventually crack this communist dictatorship where their relatives are living, or at least the president would negotiate some sort of deal that would help weaken Cuba. And then this deal, which basically gave them everything, it was enough to push enough of them into a protest vote with Trump to really deliver Florida to the Republican Party. And then it's different reasons, but in the Midwest, I mean, this is probably a protest against even Clinton and Obama and maybe even President George W. Bush, the Republican establishment, somewhat, is that you've seen the American auto industry just absolutely gutted, jobs sent overseas to China and Japan, and an area that's been a Democratic stronghold's also really given a huge protest vote, just looking for policies that will actually bring some jobs back to America, at least in their view.
I think as I was driving to the studio this morning, I saw a truck passed me, and there was a Make America Great Again hat prominently displayed on the dashboard for everyone to see which way that driver voted. And that slogan really does say a lot, besides being a masterpiece of alliteration. It's a really interesting slogan because it says that America is not great. It's sort of a slogan of warning or of worry, for sure. And different voters can define that different ways. They can define America as having been great for different reasons in the past. But you could say that one thing that unites perhaps all of Donald Trump's supporters is worry and conviction that America is not great. It is in a crisis, and I think that speaks to your point about prophecy. Which, although the average American isn't starving or in crisis personally, they see what's happening. They see what's happening in the Muslim world. They see what's happening with Russia. They see what's happening. And even in their own lives, with a government that they trust less and less, reaching more and more into their lives. And I think it's very fascinating that Americans don't think their country is great and they've got to do something before it's too late.
Yeah, it does seem like there is a certain willingness to kind of do whatever it takes to have something that's different than what we have right now. They can see the trajectory of the country in many ways, economically, politically, socially, globally, the influence of the United States going down, the cohesion of the United States being fractured. Comparisons have been made between this vote and this sort of reactionary nature of what the electorate did and the Brexit vote, which is interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it's just fascinating to see the same kind of, and even more so, just dumbfounding nature of just how different the way that the public voted was from the way that the media predicted it, and what a surprise it was. It was far more with this election than it was even with Brexit. But also just this sense of the people reacting in a very strong way to this sense of loss of control. Anything is better than what we have right now. And but the question is, well, what's going to replace it? You know, they want it to be better. They want to make it great again, or they're trying to reclaim their sovereignty in the case of Britain. But then what happens once they make that choice? And now this is the question facing America. I do want to just, Stephen Fleury talked about this on his program just in the last hour, but I do want to talk a little bit about the media. I think one point that, just speaking about reaction, that Mr. Trump made so strongly that resonated with so many people was his condemnation of the liberal press and just his the way that he excoriated just how much in the tank for Hillary Clinton they were. And I don't think there's anything that has exposed just how right he was more than what happened last night, because of how different this outcome was from what they were expecting. It was very interesting to watch the coverage, all these media personalities just expressing shock and dismay over how these results contradicted all their models and their polls and their expectations. And a number of them weren't even faking being objective. They weren't even trying to hide their disappointment. You know, just long face. I just thought it would be really interesting to just see a montage of the way that they're talking and the way that their faces, their body language, everything compared to 4 years ago or 8 years ago, as you were seeing similar numbers coming up on the screen.
I think that this was a major reaction against the media. If you took the public's outrage, the average American's outrage over what he's been seeing on TV over the last 8 years and even beyond that, and you formed it into a human being, it would be Donald Trump. It's just, he finally gave a voice to people who are just completely fed up with the system, which the system now seems to include the media, which is supposed to be the check, a check right on the entire federal government and local government. So I think that this is really a referendum in a way on what the average American thinks of the media, and it's pretty clear how that came out.
So this definitely was a reaction, a reactionary vote. It was a backlash against a lot of things. But to whatever degree Americans were reacting against things that they don't like and don't want, they did vote for this man who, he ran his own campaign his own way. In a lot of ways, this election was a vindication of this rogue type approach. He defied the Republican establishment in a lot of ways. He defied just about every political norm. He did it differently than that, and somehow he defied all of them. He defied expectations in so many ways, and he certainly has to view this victory as a pretty strong mandate. I mean, we'll see exactly how the electoral votes shake out, but it wasn't a eking out a victory. It was pretty convincing. And now what happens in America, we're going to have to live with, you know, him being at the helm. We're going to talk a little bit later about what his presidency might look like, but I'd like to focus now on what might happen in the immediate future. Today, this week, this next month, and maybe over the next 2 months before he's inaugurated, this campaign was so bruising. Really, this was the most polarized election imaginable. And to a lot of people in America today, this represents a victory for everything that's wrong with America. This is a victory for racism. This is a victory for sexism. And a lot of other unsavory things. And I remember listening to Hillary Clinton talking about him and some of the things that she was saying about him. And it went both ways. It went both ways. But I was thinking she may well be talking about our next president. And she's saying some highly inflammatory things about him. He has a long record of engaging in racist behavior and that type of thing. Last night on CNN, Stephen Fleury quoted this, Van Jones, talking about this victory being a white lash against a changing country, a white lash against a black president. He said he has Muslim friends texting him saying, well, should I leave the country? Immigrant friends who are terrified. A lot of people are very, very upset. So what is going to happen? What will the social climate be like? There were a lot of people on social media noting that today is actually the anniversary of Kristallnacht, the day that the Nazis rounded up all the Jews, and they're saying, well, history's repeating itself. America's about to round up the minorities and throw them into the concentration camps. Your thoughts on the what we might see in the time ahead here?
Well, it is kind of sad to say. I know a lot of Americans have really been just sick of how divisive and nasty parts of this election campaign have gotten, although it doesn't look like that's going to be going away anytime soon. Like, so this was, even though Mr. Trump's got a fairly sizable lead in the Electoral College, this was still a really, really close election. I was up till like 2 a.m. last night before we got a concession speech, which for the past two elections, both times Obama ran, it was usually like 10 o'clock or so. They had pretty much had it wrapped up because it's close. And I even checked the poll numbers before I came in. They're still counting every vote. And even though how our system works, even though Trump's got a very decisive lead in the Electoral College, it still looks like there are about 200,000 more Americans who voted for Hillary Clinton in this election. It's just
always a point of contention.
It's always a point of contention. I mean, it's something our founders designed it that way. They were originally, when you had 13 different colonies coming together into one nation, they had concern that maybe some of the colonies in one particular region of the nation with a sizable population could rise up and impose a president on the rest of them that none of them wanted. So the Electoral College is like a compromise way to make sure that you get a sizable portion of the vote in every area of the country to win. But that is still always a big point of contention whenever that actually happens.
Yeah, I think you can argue about the peculiarities of the Electoral College system, but I think what is the most salient point here is the emotion, the anger, the charges of racism, the sense that there is something fundamentally hostile in a Trump presidency. This is some Americans getting a sense that other Americans don't want them here. This is some Americans almost viewing a vote for Trump as, you know, something akin to the lash of a whip against them and against what they stand for. And the way that this whole campaign has kind of stirred up these kinds of grievances and this kind of emotion is extraordinary. I mean, I really wonder how much are we going to see this kind of explode in the time ahead. How much are there going to be some people who really feel like it's almost there? This is the moment to seize in order to stir that up even more. This vindicates their view of the United States as being a racist country and being, this is a time for revolution. I think there were even some people who were talking about that, like, you know, the revolution needs to start now.
The next few weeks will be very interesting because if you take some of the things that have happened recently and you put them in this time frame, for instance, a police shooting, let's say, or some other event like that, if that happened a few months ago, we saw the unrest and the negative reactions that came from that. If that same thing happens over the next couple of weeks or a few weeks before the inauguration, as you say, there will be this added dimension of we have to make the most of this for those who are interested in stirring up revolution, for those who are interested in taking a conflict and blowing it up even further. They really have an added motivation now to make the most of whatever police shooting or similar situation they can, because they feel like, or they certainly say, that once Donald Trump takes the presidency, it's going to be all over. So it'll be very interesting to see even the same types of things happen. Now, and there are also things that might be unprecedented that could happen. We don't know what the current president will do, but it has been said that he has sort of left his party behind in some cases during his presidency just to do what he feels is right, and that his party, like people in Congress, representatives in Congress, have kind of paid the price for some of the things that he's done, and he has acted without real concern for the benefit of other Democrats. Now he has no groundwork to lay for the next president.
Right.
He has
right.
no obligation to sort of, as I say, just sort of pave the runway for the next Democratic president. He has what he's painted and what has been painted as his arch rival coming up, if we can call it that, or at least someone that he's very, very negative toward.
That's a mildly put. Yeah.
So it'll just be interesting to see a president who's not afraid to use executive action for eight years to take
right.
lame duck to a new level.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about that. There were protests in Oakland, at least one place where demonstrators wanted to block the freeways. There were about 100 people, I guess, who gathered there to protest Trump's victory. Broken windows, cars on fire. You know, it's interesting. I remember thinking during the Republican National Convention, and Donald Trump was giving his speech, and he said, "If you elect me president, the lawlessness will end." You know, he didn't say I'm going to reduce the crime. He said we're going to end crime. And I thought, how do you do that? How do you prevent, say, the sniper who decides that he's going to kill a couple of police officers by setting up in a parking garage, you know, during a parade, and he decides that he's going to do that? How do you prevent someone who makes that choice? You know, it's obviously there are a lot of people who view that kind of language almost as a dare. You know, there's a certain provocative nature to it that you would expect to see increase that, or that sense that, well, now is the moment that could definitely increase. But to get to what might happen here over the next couple of months as President Obama basically tries to take advantage of his remaining time in office, your thoughts, Andrew?
Right, and I've definitely seen at least a few news analysts already predicting that his use of executive orders and executive actions is very much likely to increase. We've talked in the Trumpet magazine and on this program before quite a bit about how President Obama has almost acted like an elected monarch in some ways, to where if he wants to pass an immigration reform bill and Congress refuses to pass it, he just instructs the Department of Homeland Security to stop deporting people, which is basically unilaterally passing legislation. And this has been something that he's done several times throughout his presidency. And now, like Phil said, if he has nothing to lose, he's not laying the groundwork for a Clinton presidency. He's got someone who he basically considers his arch rival coming into the presidency. You'd see how he would have kind of be cut loose in that way in order to be, if there's anything he wants to do last minute, now is the time to do it. He's probably definitely not going to get congressional support for it, but that hasn't always stopped him in the past.
Right.
And setting a dangerous precedent. I saw we'd quoted Jonathan Turley, one of the constitutional lawyer, several times before. I saw him talking about that on a news interview last night. They had him on television, that he was saying, he, a political liberal, was saying he thinks President Obama is more likely to be using more of these executive actions, and which would even somewhat dangerously set a precedent for a Trump presidency coming in. That if he's
right.
done all these things unilaterally and President Trump wants to undo them, then what's to stop him from just doing counter executive actions, in which case the system of checks and balances that served America so well for the past two centuries just kind of unravels to where any man who can get 270 votes in the Electoral College can just pass legislation unilaterally.
There is an article up on thetrumpet.com today from Callum Wood. Stephen Fleury referenced it in the last hour. November 9th and the onslaught against Israel and how Israel is bracing itself for what President Obama might do here over these next couple of months. I'd like to encourage our listeners to go online to thetrumpet.com and look for the booklet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has just released called Great Again. He wrote his first booklet on the subject, America Under Attack. Great Again is really a follow-up to that, but it describes and explains the spiritual reality behind what the Obama administration has been doing, why it's been making so many of the decisions that it has. And it's a very important subject to understand. I think it gives us a tremendous amount of insight into what we might expect to see here over the next couple of months. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com under the Literature tab. I would really encourage you to read that booklet. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We've been talking about lessons from America's presidential election and what might happen in the short term now that the nation is coming to terms with this. Coming up, we're going to talk about a little more longer term, what a Trump presidency might look like. That is coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
America is entering a very uncertain time now. What will a Trump presidency look like? It's really hard to say in a lot of ways because we don't really have any track record to go on. And if you go purely by what he says, well, that can kind of change day to day. He'll say something one day, the next day he'll say something different, or he'll say, well, I was only joking. That was clearly intended as just making a jest, a point. But let's talk about some of the things that he has said that would give us an indication of what he might be ready to do. Let's first just focus on domestic issues. And those things that he's mentioned with respect to what he would do here at home. Your thoughts about that, Jeremiah?
Well, the big issue, I think, is immigration. You know, he's made the very famous pledges to not only build a wall along the southern border there, but to have Mexico finance that massive construction project. And immigration, in a lot of ways, I think, was the big issue of this election. It really was polarizing and brought out a lot of voters who have never voted before, both, you know, against Trump's policies and those who see the threat that this poses to America and who want to take some decisive and even unprecedented action to stem the flow of illegal immigrants into the country. So I think those who are opponents of the idea to take heavy action against it, they say this economically is going to be devastating to America and set us back a massive amount of, the GDP would be reduced considerably and things like that. But others say just as a matter of security and in order to make sure that we have a country that people desire to even come to, it's important to, you know, have walls, to have borders that are enforceable and that are enforced.
I think Mr. Trump did a very good job of identifying some of the major, even existential problems facing the United States. And he, once having identified them and kind of tapped into that sense among Americans that this really is something that is problematic, that we need to do something about it, some of his proposals were, you know, pretty strong type proposals that maybe you can do them, maybe you can't. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how he operates, having been the CEO of companies and just been able to call the shots the way that he saw them. how he operates once he's in the machinations of Washington, and you're dealing with a legislature and you're dealing with a judiciary and you're supposedly trying to operate within the constitutional confines of the presidency. But I wonder how much success is he actually going to be able to find in implementing some of the promises that he's made with respect to, say, just looking at immigration. Can he build the wall? What will people do? Those people that whose emotions have gotten all stirred up and they're saying, we want the wall, we want the wall, or we want to, you know, stop this flow of Syrian immigrants and so on. If that can happen, or to whatever degree that can happen, what are people going to do if they don't get what they want? It's an interesting question. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens there. How well is he able to implement it? What happens if he can't?
This is definitely a good point. I mean, to identify a problem is one thing, and to actually be able to solve it is something different. And that is one thought I had, just getting back to more of like a prophetic standpoint, is that one of the key prophecies from the book of Isaiah that we've drawn a lot of attention to. Mr. Gerald Fleury had a whole cover story in the Trumpet a couple months back on the South China Sea and the risk of this trade war or enemies of America encircling them with hostile trade policies. And as you say, Mr. Trump has done an admirable job at identifying that the fact that we have this enormous trade deficit is a problem, the fact that we have these jobs going overseas is a problem, may have even given him the election, as people in the Midwest and Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania are voting for the fact that he is one of the few politicians who actually recognizes that this is a problem. But on the other hand, some of his proposals, like such as slapping a 45% tariff on China to bring jobs back here, you have to realize that this trade deficit is something, a problem that's built over 50 years as we've industrialized, and it's almost like a drug addict. If you try to go cold turkey off heroin, you may just die foaming at the mouth and a seizure on the floor. And so it is a problem that needs to be addressed, but if you don't have enough finesse to it to just start slapping these huge tariffs on foreign nations like China or Europe, they can slap just as big a tariffs right back at you and really isolate you from the rest of the world.
You know, you were talking before about President Obama's executive orders and just how much he has expanded the powers of the executive branch. This is a precedent. The precedent that has been set here is of great concern. When you talk about the kind of personality, demagoguery, you know, populist type person that Donald Trump is, what does he do with those kinds of powers? President Obama, having established this precedent that the executive really can't, and the president specifically, can really take whatever actions he wants, and he's done a lot of things without congressional approval. How much are we going to? I mean, it's hard to see, with the law being as trampled as it has been under the Obama administration, it's hard to see that trend being reversed. All of Mr. Trump's speeches about, you know, establishing conservative justices on the Supreme Court aside, just looking at it from a standpoint of a man who wants to get things done, you know, what's going to happen to the state of the rule of law in America?
Well, I think his campaign gives us a clue to that. And I think it's so hard to know what that presidency is going to be like, because you look at Jeremiah compiled this list of campaign promises, and it's just one thing after another, after another, after another, that just seem so impossible once you hit the political realities of Washington, once you hit the things that have been building and been put in place over a period of decades. What I see is he is just a huge question mark, a huge loose cannon. Because when I see those all those promises listed out, I see someone who is, and all politicians do this, and we as an electorate have come to be used to it and to accept it.
Right.
But he's just telling people what they want to hear. In many of these cases, we have never had a president with no prior public office experience in this country, and we're about to get one. He has plenty of business experience, but he has never been controlled by the Constitution in his job. I think you know what I mean by that. But he's never been had to learn to build consensus or get backing from a separate branch of, you know, Trump Incorporated. Like he was able to run his companies more or less the way he wanted, presumably. So we have someone with no prior experience, no prior voting record, nothing to pin on him, and he's made a bunch of promises, and he's also been able to, as you say, sort of play some of those off and sort of shrug some of those promises off. So in the same way that in 2008 we saw the Obama campaign say, you know, hope and change, and you voters, just whatever that means to you, that's what we're going to give you. You know, we give you those positive words. He talks about make America great again. He talks about it's going to be so great, you know, and he uses those types of terms. And you kind of accept that. That's kind of his personality. But
you
now
can't
we can't
say
pin
that
anything
for four
on
years.
Him. Right. You can't.
You can't keep saying it's going to be so great. There's a point where the expectations begin to smack into reality, and people say, well, okay, now it's time to deliver. And so I almost see two dynamics or two potential dynamics here that could be at work. One is exactly what you're describing, those political realities and the roadblocks that he finds himself encountering that he's unaccustomed to. And you know, it's interesting, especially looking at that in light of the way that he ran his campaign, because when he saw a roadblock, he just went right through it, you know, time after time after time. There were people who were in his face saying, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. He said, I'm going to do it. This is the way that I am, and I'm not going to change who I am for the sake of, you know, bowing down to you. So you could see, I mean, it does maybe give you some insight into the way that he might deal with some of those roadblocks. But on the other hand, that being the case, he might just go ahead and take the Obama approach to executive power and double it and just double down on those same kinds of, you know, I'm going to do what I want to do type policies.
If that happens, then this vote basically nailed the last lid on the coffin of the Constitution.
Well, I think you could pretty well say that it did that. I mean, who voted for the Constitution? Who was even thinking about the Constitution? Who was thinking about the rule of law? If anyone was really thinking about that, I mean, those who were thinking about that were not voting for Donald Trump at any stage in this whole election and this whole campaign. So what we ended up with was something very different, very, very contrary to that way of thinking.
Right, and he assumes a presidency that does already have, has already developed huge powers beyond what the Constitution provided. It is a different thing than what is in the Constitution, the presidency today, and Americans have accepted that over the years.
Right. Well, we've kind of demanded it. I mean, it's almost like you look at the way that, say, Theodore Roosevelt started to transform the presidency, and the way that he said, I'm going to take power, whatever power the Constitution doesn't explicitly say I can't have, I'm going to go ahead and take that. Rather than looking at it in terms of here's the way that the Constitution narrowly defines the presidency, stay within these bounds, color within the lines, Theodore Roosevelt said, no, I'll color where I want as long as, you know, no, it doesn't specifically forbid that. And now, 100 years down the track, Americans have given a great big bear hug to that view of the presidency.
Right. It is definitely get back to the people, the American people, and what they demand. I was reading a book on the Great Depression recently and Calvin Coolidge, and it just really struck me that there was this flood on the Mississippi River, and the people asked him, and they said, "Well, Mr. President, what are you going to do about this flood and all the people who need help?" And he's like, "Well," he said, "constitutionally, the governor of the state it happened in, I think it was Mississippi, needs to ask me before I'm going to get federal involvement in this issue. It looks like he's got state resources and he's got it handled, so I'm just not going to get involved." Which was
that
really,
wouldn't fly
it
today.
Was a popular answer then. People elected Calvin Coolidge because he had that type of constitutional mindset. Now they'd be like, "Well, what do you mean you don't want to? We want the full force of the federal government down on this this issue." And speaking of the 1920s when Coolidge was president, this is actually the first time since 1928 that there's been a Republican president, a Republican Senate, and a Republican House, I believe, all at the same time. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a strong mandate, at least for his first term, or at least for the next 2 years.
2 years.
Assuming the Republican establishment goes along with what he wants to do.
Right.
To do this. But
a lot of questions about what might happen there. But let's turn now to foreign policy. You mentioned trade protectionism and the kind of trade wars that might happen. That's certainly something that we will need to watch, what happens economically with the United States' relationship with other nations, other issues that we might be looking at. Jeremiah, maybe you can take it.
Yeah, this election has really garnered the attention of the whole world. U.S. elections pretty much always do that, but this one in particular has been viewed as just very captivating and relevant. Everyone can see the myriad crises unfolding all over the planet. They see the fruits of the Obama administration and the Bush administration before that. And they know that Trump is a wild card in many ways. Like Philip said, he's a huge question mark. He's not a career politician. He's not beholden to the military establishment or super PACs or wealthy donors and others the way most politicians have been. And if he is to be taken at his word, then he's really eager to make some huge changes, not just the domestic ones that we've discussed, but in the role that America plays abroad. This morning, Mr. Trump's been receiving congratulations from many different world leaders from all around the globe, but one of them caught my eye, and really it's no surprise, but that was from Russian President Vladimir Putin. In the early hours of this morning, just a little while after Mr. Trump's victory was made official, Putin sent him a telegram just congratulating him and saying that Putin's eager to work with Trump and to restore the damaged ties that have happened under the Obama administration. And it wasn't just Putin. The entire Russian parliament apparently burst into applause after Trump's victory was confirmed. So the Russians are really thrilled about this looming change in American leadership. And I think that if you look at some of the statements that Trump made during his campaign, it shows why this is more than just some vague mutual respect that two strongman style leaders have for each other. Back in July, just after Trump secured the Republican nomination, he said that he would be absolutely prepared to tell U.S. allies, such as the NATO countries, "Congratulations, you will be defending yourselves," unless they agree to start to shoulder a lot more of the costs for American troop presence. And then a little later in that interview, he said, "How is this helping us? Despite the fact that, you know, we are treaty bound to go to the aid of those other NATO nations if they're attacked, we need to be prepared to walk away from that treaty since it's not in our best interest." So, and he's made several other statements since then along those same lines. And this kind of statement would be the best news that Vladimir Putin could hear. You know, the Russians view NATO as really hedging them in and really stifling their power and their interests. They view NATO as a threat. And it's also clear that the bulk of NATO's power has come from America's underpinnings, America's investment into it. So this idea that he would be willing to sort of break that alliance. And then he's also said that it's time for America to either end or greatly scale back on its role as the global policeman, sort of the policeman of the world. You know, for decades, the U.S. has been intervening in all kinds of pockets and just ensuring that the channels of commerce remain opened, working to stabilize the world as much as possible. But now Trump's saying that the U.S. has spent way too much of its treasure and its blood in this kind of stuff. We've got enough of our own problems at home. We've got a massive debt that we need to take care of. And he says it's time for us to really end this act as global policemen. So
it's one of the things that I think it's been somewhat of a contradiction at the heart of a lot of what he has said foreign policy-wise, because he's talked in one sense about how we need to restore our respect among nations, that we're not respected, we're being trampled on, and so on. And at the same time, he seems pretty strongly advocating the same kind of move toward isolationism and a reduction in America's role in the world. And so it's almost like, say, the same way that we've seen this massive erosion in the rule of law in the United States under an Obama administration, and the Trump kind of represents the apotheosis of that trend, or this the cementing of that trend. In some ways, I think the American isolationism and withdrawal from the world would have a similar cementing under a Trump presidency.
Yeah, I think it really would. It would be the continuation of some of that scaling back that's already happened. And really, from the perspective of America, it sounds pretty good. It sounds like, you know, you're right. We do have massive debt. We do have all kinds of problems of our own, a serious array of them. So let's stop pumping all of this wealth into other countries. But for the rest of the world, if he follows through on those kinds of promises, it could have some really serious and quite, you know, destructive repercussions, I think.
I think you heard that even just in the news headlines that came out of Europe, where the conservative leader in the European Parliament, Manfred Weber, he said, well, this means that the Europe has to step up, that we have to be more self-confident, we have to assume more responsibility, recognizing that America is stepping back and we can't rely on it. And I think that here we are sitting around a table talking about, well, who knows what's going to happen? What about leaders in foreign capitals who are trying to make decisions about their own security and their own path forward and have no idea whether they can rely on the United States for anything? You're absolutely going to see that increase, an acceleration of that rush to fill the void that America is leaving behind.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And also, if he plans to really stick to this plan to scale back the U.S. role as global policeman, it has included some statements about allowing nations such as Japan to develop nuclear weapons. And that could really fulfill some specific prophecies that at the trumpet we're watching for. Matthew 24 there talks about, you know, a time of devastation that could threaten every life on the planet. And if he's encouraging a nation like Japan that has a pretty frightening track record militaristically to become once again a full-fledged military power, including a nuclear power, then that could just be, you know, a sobering development.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We've been talking about what a future Trump presidency might look like. I was hoping that we could talk about maybe some of the other issues that happened. But why don't you, 30 seconds, what else did we see? I think we definitely see an expansion of the marijuana laws in the United States. Anything else?
Yeah, they did have several down ballot issues this year, on some on health care, some on minimum wage, some on the death penalty, some on like drug legalizations. A lot of those votes are still being counted, but that does seem to be the two big ones that look like they're expanding is minimum wage and marijuana legalization. I think California, Nevada, Maine have all legalized marijuana, so that's the complete West Coast now that they join the other state. So that is a trend that's moving forward regardless of who the president is.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like Washington, Oregon, and one other state, they're all voted to increase their minimum wage up above $12 an hour. So that is also another trend that's just taking hold in more and more states regardless of who the president's going to be.
In the last couple of days, we heard an interesting word into the discussion from some commentators. CBS News contributor Bob Schieffer said that he'd never seen a campaign like this one. And he didn't mean that in a positive way. He said, I've seen a few, but I've run out of ways to say I've never seen one like this. It's as if the nation is enduring some kind of curse. What should we expect next? That it will rain frogs? I wouldn't bet against it. Peggy Noonan wrote this in her Wall Street Journal column earlier this week. She said, a closing thought. God is in charge of history. He asks us to work, to try, to pour ourselves out, to make things better. But he is an actor in history also. He chastises and rescues. He intervenes in ways seen and unseen, or chooses not to. 2016 looks to me like a chastisement. He's trying to get our attention. We have candidates we can't be proud of. We must choose among the embarrassments. What might we be doing as a nation and a people that would have earned this moment? It's quite a statement in the Wall Street Journal from Peggy Noonan. And I think she really puts her finger on a very important point that you just don't hear. I mean, it's very unusual to hear that kind of language coming from a mainstream source like that. But what struck me about it, more than the fact that she's identified that this is a moment of curse for the United States, is she has no idea, apparently, what we might be doing, or she's not willing to say it in the Wall Street Journal, what might we be doing as a nation and a people that would have earned this kind of chastisement from God? She's definitely onto something, but she doesn't know. She's in the dark when it comes to what we might be doing. But if you look at America today and the kinds of sins and the kinds of problems that Americans are creating for ourselves, surely this is no mystery. And surely the problems that we see and the fact that this election unfolded the way that it did, it should not be a mystery to us why God would actually be chastising us. I want to point again to this booklet from our editor-in-chief, great again. Go online to thetrumpet.com under the literature tab and read it. I just want to finish the program today with a few quotes from this in the introduction to this booklet. He talked about how Donald Trump has identified the problems in the United States, and the Make America Great Again slogan addresses those concerns. He said that slogan resonates with a lot of people who believe the United States has been mainly a positive force in the world. Anyone who sincerely admires this country wants to see America made great again. But if you understand the spiritual dimension of why America is no longer great as it once was, you will know why no politician is going to be able to turn things around. The Bible has a lot to say about the state of America today. It explains the inspiring reason why this nation was so great, why it has been so richly blessed. The Bible also prophesies that these blessings would be removed in our day, replaced by terrible curses because of the sins of the people. Yes, as a consequence of deep and multiplying materialism, selfishness, lust, immorality and idolatry among the American people, those prophesied curses are descending rapidly. America's problems are spiritual, and solving them requires spiritual solutions, starting with repentance. But Americans are too entrenched in their sin to do that, so the national curses are going to get far worse before they ever get better. I really would encourage you to read that booklet. I'd encourage you to read The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That really does give the overview of what we can expect to see in the time ahead. Whatever that might be, under a Trump presidency or whatever might happen. But it is important to understand that as bad as a curse on the nation sounds, it actually is intended to turn the nation around and help the nation recognize and repent of its sins so we can begin to receive God's blessings and favor once again. And it is just the most inspiring thing when you really view it in its entire context, the way that God explains it in Scripture. It really does have a very, very positive outcome. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel today, Philip Nice, Jeremiah Jacques, and Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from James Freeman Clark. A politician thinks of the next election. A statesman thinks of the next generation. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
To Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.